Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So, some big news in the gaming world. Call of Cthulhu 7th Edition was announced.
Wow. Might need to buy a new book.
Not until 2013.
All right. Gives me time to save. Wonder how much they're going to crowdsource on this one.
I don't know. That is a good question, though.
Because we can contrast that with D&D Next, which seems to be the ultimate in crowdsourcing.
Yeah, right. Do you like the name D&D?
Of course, it's what I love. Yeah.
That's pretty much what it boils down to, though, what they're doing.
And can we just be clear, Next, just an experiment? Let's see how that goes.
Just put out some feelers.
I'm going to take a poll in a month, see how people feel.
Well, I guess that is kind of, not to go back to Call of Cthulhu, but it is one of the smart things. Like, the people who were talking about it, they said, nothing is set in stone, right? Like, we're playtesting it, you know, the information we're giving you now may change, so don't get attached to it.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that they kind of have to say that, you know, just kind of, you know, making sure that, I guess, nobody gets angry, because, you know, you can get kind of angry.
Nah, nerd rage has no barriers on that. People will get angry.
What do you guys think of the D&D crowdsourcing so much? Like, getting so much feedback from people. The most recent survey is here are the magic spells. Pick them for every level.
Yeah.
What they should be for every level. The iconic ones for every level.
I think that's pretty cool.
Really? Can I ask why? Because I had exact opposite reaction.
Yeah. I saw your email on that. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think I imagine that they're doing a lot of work with changing everything around from 4E. So they're probably reworking the magic system quite a bit. Again, this is all just speculation on my part. But if that's the case, then they probably want to know what spells they should keep in order to keep D&D flavor to it. And a great way of doing that is just asking the people, what do you think of as the quintessential D&D spells?
I honestly don't mind the survey. I'll fill mine out soon. But in general, I think they're doing too much, throwing stuff out. And I think there was a talking to Wayne today about, they said something, it's just an experiment, but we're planning to lower hit points and see if that makes healing more meaningful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, shrug, just an experiment, sounds all right. But I guess it kind of lit up the forums.
Yeah, not as much as, it was the Mike Merle's most recent Legends and Lore article, and it was just one sentence up the beginning that said that. And yeah, the internet didn't like explode as opposed to like previous Legend and Lore articles that came up, but people were still kind of grousing about that.
You're just like, why? Obviously, they're going to test it, see how it goes. I mean, these people are paid to design the games.
Mm-hmm.
They work for Dungeons & Dragons, so perhaps they know what Dungeons & Dragons is. Do they really need to throw out everything, every rule change or every concept or everything that they're testing? What do you guys think?
That's the part I didn't like.
Because you're not going to please everybody.
Right.
Because some people are going to go, well, I really like that. And then they don't do it. And they're like, well, I like that. And I sent you those surveys. And I sent you those 5 emails afterwards. And I called. Did you not get my calls?
I waited outside the WotC headquarters with a bouquet of roses.
I sent you a birthday present.
I sent you that dog's head. Did you not get that? I said keep the hit points low. I don't know. Sometimes crowdsourcing can be really good, but sometimes it really makes me roll my eyes. There's a company called Threadless, and they make these t-shirts, and they've got designs. And what they do is they throw it out, and the community, they call it, submits the designs, and people vote on them. And on the one hand, you say, yeah, I guess that's kind of cool. On the other hand, you're like, well, it's just t-shirts. You know, you can't take another company, a clothing company or a fashion company. They can't really do that, because at the end of the day, you kind of want somebody to be an expert on design and fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And tell you, no, you know something? This is cool. Because a lot of people don't know what they want. They don't know what's cool. They don't know what they like. And then you give it to them and go, no, this is awesome. Did people go, you know, I wish there was a vampire game where there was all these clans and how about dots? Dots, and we roll those and each dot represent. No, they didn't know that. And then, you know, White Wolf rolls out that game and then people, I like this.
Whoa, dots! That's awesome!
And clans!
Wait a minute. I like how you did that. How about just vampires?
Yeah. I didn't know I like vampires. Yeah.
You're absolutely right, Lyle. There's a reason that the words designed by committee are not a compliment.
No, I was just going to say, like, for me, I don't mind feedback, right? Because they're a company. WotC wants to succeed. Hasbro wants them to succeed. They want 5th edition to succeed. So do I. But if you just kind of send out a survey about every little thing and saying, you know, telling us, what do you want to see? It feels patronizing to me, right? I would much prefer them to roll out a big chunk, say, play this, did you like it, yes, no, why not, you know, did it feel like D&D? Not all these specific little questions of, do you want there to be iconics in the book? Remember in 3.5, we had sort of like the same characters throughout the book, you know, in the illustrations. Yeah. I don't need a survey asking me if I want to see that in the book. I don't need a survey, or I don't need articles explaining why, you know, the book is going to lurk a certain way, or, you know, a survey of what kind of features do you want in it, or to pick the spells. I found that survey incredibly boring, because to me, it's not the spells that make D&D feel like D&D, it's the wizard. And I don't really care what spells he has, so long as you have that fancy and magic wizard. That feels like D&D. And I could care less what spells you have.
I gotta disagree there, man. Like, if I had a D&D Vancian wizard, but he didn't have magic missile, it would definitely feel less like D&D to me.
But, okay, well, but do you really think there's a danger that there's not gonna be magic missile?
No, not at all. But, obviously.
You wanna know why? Because the designers know that. The designers know magic missile and fireball, those are iconic things. Or they wouldn't be designers. It's not like they picked these guys off the street. So, do you ever play a role-playing game? No.
How would you like to?
Yeah. Oh, I studied English literature, yeah. How many Oscar Wilde quotes can I throw into D&D? How about not a lot? Okay.
I actually missed the Legend and Lore article you're talking about there, Wayne. But did he come out and ask all that stuff? Do you want to see characters drawn up in the books or about the lowered hit points? Was that in a question or a poll or something?
The thing about iconics was from a previous article, and it was more just an article about our thought process behind making D&D next.
Okay.
And types of questions we might ask. The thing about the hit points, it was a single line at the top of the monster building article that just said, we are experimenting with lowering hit points to see if that makes healing feel more meaningful. Because
okay.
I guess the most feedback they're getting back is we don't like healing.
Hmm.
But there was no, like, they didn't say, and here's rules for it. They didn't say, and here's when you can see rules for it, you know, coming out. It's just that one line, we don't even really know what it means.
Okay, so it wasn't really part of a survey. It was just saying this is kind of the direction we're going, and a lot of people responded to it.
Right.
Okay, but you know, I agree with what you're saying. I think it probably would have been better if they'd maybe sent out a questionnaire to begin with, like, what is D&D to you, and then maybe kind of sent it out in a big chunk, like, here's the playtest, give it a try and tell us what you think, rather than kind of the piecemeal thing that they're doing now. So I do agree with that.
Yeah. But we're also talking, after we recorded the episode last week, we're just talking about magic in general and about Vancian magic. And whether, like, how much leeway do they really have in D&D?
I'm thinking none.
So it's like, yeah, what kind of magic system? Well, it's going to be Vancian magic because they've just kind of boxed themselves in. And everybody thinks, well, that's D&D. Like, these things are D&D. These classes are D&D. And there's only so much they can do. So we were talking about magic and just fantasy in general. And then Wayne mentioned he was talking to somebody on Twitter.
Yeah, because I always check Twitter to see just, you know, what people's reactions to the
you should probably, you could have ended that sentence, I always check Twitter.
Well, okay, yeah, fair enough, all right.
Every minute of every day.
All right. Anyway, kind of the person I was arguing with said that D&D was, is, and should be the sort of the gateway to RPGs, or at least pen and paper RPGs, and I disagreed.
Why?
Yes, why?
Sorry, did I not sound enthusiastic? maybe because I already know the answer.
fair enough. But
I get Wayne's tweets directly.
Yeah. I just think, on principle, why does there only have to be one entry product to the hobby? D&D probably, unless they screw up D&D next, D&D will probably always be the biggest one who attracts the most people, but I don't think you can or should say that it has to be the only one, the gateway to the hobby.
Sure. I can see people entering through other things if they have different interests, if they like vampires or like science fiction. But it's a very social game. So if you can't find players, I mean...
Well, that goes for any kind of pen and paper RPG. I can't find a player. I'll just...
That's what I mean.
DM myself. Yeah.
No, I didn't mean D&D is a social game.
Oh.
Sorry. I mean, sorry, the hobby. It's a very social hobby. It's a very social type of game. So, I mean, if you can't find players, you're just not going to play.
Hmm.
You can't just, like, hook yourself up to the console or... I mean, sure, you can go online and try to find people. But you do need, like, kind of that core game where you can walk into your gaming store or at school there's going to be a club and everybody has played it or is currently playing it.
Although they may disavow knowledge of doing so.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think D&D no comment on whether or not it should be, but I think D&D is pretty well set up to be the gateway game. I mean, it's got the name recognition. Almost everyone around has heard the words D&D before. And I think we were discussing a little while ago that, like, a template-based system where you can layer a class and a race onto your character makes it a lot easier and more accessible to someone who's never tried it before. They can say, okay, I want to be the fighty guy. Here's a fighter template. And you know, it is still really popular. You can go to almost any game store you want, and they probably have a Wednesday night D&D group going on kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but I think, and I've heard other people say this, if the DM builds the character, why can't you sort of use any game to bring someone in? Because, like, I mean, you slap a D&D book in front of someone who's never really played, they're not really going to build their own character.
Aye.
You
two,
know?
Two words? Apocalypse World?
Well, I said someone who knows the game well.
No, but if somebody built the character for you, and you walk in and you go, oh, we're going to play Apocalypse World, well, what kind of game is it? Post-apocalypse. Sorry, what kind? But if somebody goes, it's a fantasy game, they go, yeah, sure, there's a lot of fantasy stories out there, but I think you're going to have a pretty good idea of the type of game you're in store for.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody goes, oh, we're going to play a game called Vampire the Masquerade. And I'm like, are we going to play Twilight? Well, not exactly. Are we going to play True Blood? Oh, a little closer, maybe.
It's more like Blade.
So I'm the vampire hunter? And they're like, no, you're the vampire. And I'm like, okay, you know.
Vampires are gay. See you guys later.
Yeah. I can do that. I think it's a very accessible thing. Even if it's a science fiction game, we've talked about this before, is like, well, what does that really mean to somebody?
Yeah.
It's like, am I playing iRobot? Am I playing Star Wars? Am I?
Actually, with that point, you know, D&D is really flexible as to whatever kind of character you want to play. You can have somebody playing Merlin from Excalibur right next to somebody playing Conan.
I don't see quite the gap there, but all right.
I was trying to think of a more cerebral fantasy movie, but I couldn't get it.
Let's see. Fantasy archetypical characters in D&D. Yeah, that works. All right.
So they could play Merlin, or they could play like King Arthur, but no armor, a little more buff. Oh, yeah. I could see that mashup. So we were talking about that after the last episode, and the last episode was fairly fluffy and not as game-related as we intended. We kind of got sidetracked on talking about evolution, Marxism,
xenophobia.
All those fun topics, yeah.
Yeah, we were very passionate about colonialism.
Well, at least I was.
So we thought, well, this episode, we're deliberately going to do a crunchier, gamier episode, and since we were talking a lot about just fantasy and whether or not D&D should be the gateway, I actually thought we'd talk about non-D&D fantasy games. I think the listeners are going, thank God.
Unless they tuned in for D&D, and then they're like, oh, I'm out.
I think the title, non-D&D fantasy,
might throw some people, yeah.
I think we lost, actually, most of the listeners in the first 20 minutes talking.
Yeah, right.
These guys have a strange idea of non-D&D. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at a few non-D&D fantasy games, and we'll talk about the setting, the system, magic, if it's applicable, and the presentation. And then we're going to give our verdict, like, who would be interested in it, who wouldn't be interested in it, and whether we like it or not. All right, so first up is Exalted.
The premise in Exalted is that you are playing a sort of mortal being.
Called Solars?
Yeah, look at you busting out that little bit of Exalted knowledge. Pat yourself on the back there. I wish you could see the smile on Lyle's face just then.
Ear to ear.
Yeah, priceless. So yes, you're playing these sort of beings called Solars, who have kind of a shard of divinity in them. They were created by gods to be both sort of their instrument and champions on Earth to fight against these primordial titans, very in kind of like a Greek mythology kind of way. So the characters in the world are essentially kind of like demigods. The core book says you sort of all play, I guess, avatars or demigods connected to this one particular god. There's four or five. And like most White Wolf games, you're kind of at a disadvantage because the setting believes in reincarnation, and that when one of these exalted dies, their kind of spirit recycles and then exalts somebody else. So you kind of have like this endless cycle. But in the setting for the past 800 years, these Solar Exalted were trapped in sort of like a prison and demonized and sort of almost wiped out of the history of the Earth. And the basic story is now these Solar Exalted are starting to sort of leak back into the world, and you are one of these very few types of exalted. So, I thought that was pretty interesting in that it kind of sets up, like, people don't think you're good. You're going to be kind of hunted from the beginning. of the setup.
The thing that struck me about it is that it's very, very anime-based. Like, everything in it is designed to be over the top. The weapons are enormous. The powers are out of this world, you know. You go up and you battle actual gods as regular enemies. So it's cool.
So they also have a group called the Dragon Blooded?
Yes. There are other kinds of Exalted. Like, I think there's about like 4 or 5 other Exalted. But in sort of the main book, it only deals with these Solar Exalted. The other Exalted are explored in other books.
All right.
No, I just kind of thought that was...
I expected Jack to explain who the Dragon Blood was.
Oh, sorry.
Because there's the Lunars, and you would say like they're kind of like the wolves?
Oh, they're
Yeah, they're like werewolf shapeshifters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, no. Chris, you really like this setting.
Yes, very much so.
Just because could you kind of feel like a hero or a superhero, maybe?
Yeah, and actually, you know, that's a good way of putting it, is that, you know, we've said before that D&D is kind of like a superhero fantasy game, but this one is unabashedly so.
Yeah. I'm less of a fan, but I think it's also because I'm probably of the three, I'm the least interested in anime.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne is signaling that he's not very interested in either, but one of us has anime dolls in their apartment.
Not saying who, Wayne.
So let's say he's +1 on the anime scale. So even though I'm a huge fan of the World of Darkness, and I really like the system, I actually prefer, if I was going to do fantasy, and we're not going to get into this game too much because we already talk enough about Vampire, is like Vampire Dark Ages. That was where I would get my fantasy fix with that similar system.
Like, generally, I'm not a fan of the over-the-top sort of super heroic story, which is part of the reason why I didn't like D&D 4E. Because as Chris said, and as we said before, you feel like fantasy superheroes. But I think part of the reason I didn't really care for 4E all that much was there's no explanation why. You're just heroes, and you're just kind of mechanically better than everyone else. Whereas with Exalted, there's a reason. You actually are a demigod. And while there's no reason you can't say that when you play D&D 4E, I just like how in the Exalted setting, it's spelled out. All the characters are gods. And I think that's why I can accept that they can do all this incredible stuff.
Solves a lot of problems. Why are you all together? Because you're all gods.
Yeah.
You're all soulers.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you're all soulers. You're all avatars or tools of the same god.
Did we meet in the tavern? Nope.
Nope. Like,
we met in heaven.
Yeah, and you brought up Vampire. One of the background questions I saw in the Exalted book specifically said sort of when you're building your character, it said, how do you feel about mortals? Because you're not one of them anymore.
Hmm.
And it goes back to why had that problem with D&D. It's like, am I on the same level as, you know, the peasants in the field, or am I, you know, kind of this epic guy? I felt like D&D 4E could never really decide, and it didn't really tell me. Whereas that one question, how do you feel about mortals because you're not one of them anymore, and how is that going to affect your character, and how are you going to deal with that? I made me think of Vampire, and it's, of course, no mistake that they're both by White Wolf Games, but I really liked that.
Oh, it's definitely one of those, like, fantasy books where it's Wizard's First Rule jumps to mind, where it's not like the farm boy who pretty much just becomes a farm boy and gets a little bit better with the sword. No, it's like, well, you've got that spark of divinity or that thing that makes you special.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you are. And Exalt is like, yep, that's right. And why should one person be special? You're all special.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've alluded to it, Wayne, but what's the system for that?
The system is very similar to Old World of Darkness, with maybe a little bit of New World of Darkness in there. So it's basically...
World of Darkness.
Yeah, all right, there you go. Medium World of Darkness.
Actually, that's pretty accurate because it forms like a little bridge.
Yeah, it does.
So what they did is some of the changes that they made were incorporated in the new World of Darkness system.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a dice pool mechanic. You have dots like all White Wolf games, and they just form a dice pool. 7 or higher success, just like the New World of Darkness, and you're trying to beat a target number for most actions.
And are they using D10s?
Yes, they are.
There you go.
They're using D6s. Oh, hard to hit that 7. The one small difference is there's no 10 again rule. 10 just counts as 2 successes rather than allowing you to reroll.
I see.
Well, they also have the stunting rules, which I think is one of the best parts of that game.
Are they small people?
Sorry?
Stunting?
Oh, Zion, you clever man.
Oh, the stunting rules are if you add extra description to your action, again, kind of with the over-the-top anime feel of the game, then you're allowed to add extra dice to your roll.
Yeah, I think it goes up to 3. In the Exalted book, it actually says pretty clearly that the players are allowed to sort of create content in the scene, so long as it doesn't go against anything that you've already established or you've established but just haven't told the players. So I think for maybe when it was written, which is about 2006, I won't say it's the first game to do that, but it definitely has like a section that says it's okay to do this, which kind of ties into that stunting mechanic that kind of, yeah, okay, as a player, you say something cool and, you know, you get a mechanical bonus for it.
Well, that's something that the Fudge system and the Fate system has been doing for a long time, but it's definitely, I think, one of the first of the mainstream games to adopt that kind of storytelling technique.
What about the magic system?
The magic system is kind of not non-existent. There's magic in the setting, more so than other games we'll look at, but closest I can sort of think it to is more like the sort of D&D 4E ritual magic, where it usually will take a long time, it's kind of difficult to do, and you're not really going to see it in combat.
Okay.
It's an over-the-top game, but it's more like martial arts over-the-top. Like, you kind of have like an inner power source that you're using to make yourself better. And yes, there are kind of ways you can cast spells and sort of, you know, expend your essence through other things, but usually it's going to be sort of enhancing yourself rather than casting magical spells.
All right.
Cool.
What about the presentation?
I think it's a pretty good-looking book. I mean, I guess the one gripe I had with it is very anime-influenced or manga-influenced, and they have several pages of stories that read like a comic book. And yeah, it looks nice, but from what I saw, they don't really seem to relate to the chapter they're in. It doesn't really tie to game mechanics, you know? It's not someone sort of explaining the world in the setting chapter. It's not someone in a fight in the combat chapter. It's not someone doing magic in the magic chapter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Like, maybe I'm wrong, but from what I saw, it just kind of, I didn't really see any tie between this little story I'm being told and the chapter it's in.
Actually, I quite enjoyed reading those. They were just fun. Yeah, you're right. They aren't very well tied to it, but I enjoyed it. Like, actually, overall, I thought the book was really nice. It was, the artwork is good, better than most White Wolf products, and very colorful, and yeah, I think it's a nicely put together book.
I think you can say you like it better than other White Wolf products as a personal preference, but I actually like the art in Vampire Requiem better than in Exalted.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, of course, just my opinion for that.
Yeah, no, I think it is well presented, solid book, good art. Don't particularly care for that style. I've already said I'm not a big fan of anime. But I'd certainly be happy. I wouldn't feel like it got ripped off after buying that book.
Mm. Mm-hmm. But saying that, I think the person who would want to play this game is someone who likes anime, or someone who likes comic books, or someone who likes sort of that, you know, wire fu, kung fu action style movie, because that's what the game is. Like, there's enough in the setting, and there seems to be, like, a lot of social stuff going on at the time.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you could play an only social game. And again, I've said before, books, by just how big certain chapters are, tell you what the focus of the game is. Like D&D 4th edition, the core book, combat is a big honking chapter, and that says this is kind of the focus of the game. Same thing with Exalted. Like, you look at the charms section, which are the way you kind of like enhance your abilities, it's a massive chapter,
mm-hmm.
and combat is a massive chapter,
right.
And that's obviously what this game is about. So, if you like beating stuff up and pretending to be a god...
All right, could this be the gateway or not?
I'm actually kind of on the fence, because reading it actually made my head hurt.
Okay.
It looks
in what way?
So what fence is this? This sounds like the fence of no.
Well, but like I said in the beginning.
I'm kind of on the fence, but I'm on the no side of
the
fence.
I'm on the no side of the fence, but what I mean is, I think for any game, if the game master knows the system well, they can make any system easy.
Okay. It's not a cop-out question. It's a... Yes or no?
Okay, then you got my answer. I'm on the no side of the fence.
Since when did you become coy? All right. How about you, Chris? What do you think?
Sadly, no. I think this game has a lot going for it that could make it a gateway game. It's very filled with action. It taps into the kind of that anime meme that is quite popular now. And I don't think that it's very difficult. The dice pool system is pretty easy to pick up. However, the system is very much tied to the world and the setting. And the setting is a pretty dense bit. It's a good half of a thick book. So I don't think that it'd be something easy for new players to just pick up and run with. But that said, I think it definitely has potential too. If someone were interested and they read some stuff online, then it wouldn't be too hard to jump into the world as a new player.
I think, yeah, no. I think you really have to buy into the anime, and I think it'd be tough to get a mix of people that buy in that much.
Hmm.
I know there's a lot of people who like manga and anime and the gamer world, but I think you'll find more people that like a more traditional fantasy setting more.
Hmm.
All right. Well, next up, we're going to look at a Song of Ice and Fire role-playing. And I think my biggest complaint about this is the title, which is a bit long. and it's by Robert J. Schwab. And people who are fans of D&D will recognize that name because his name has appeared in a lot of the credits, which is one of the reasons why I'm not crazy about crowdsourcing, because if you're going to hire somebody like that to work on D&D next, let him work, you know? I'd rather buy something by him than something by, you know, like a dozen people in Wisconsin who I've never met. Those of you familiar with A Song of Ice and Fire, it's, I probably don't need to say what I'm going to say next. I don't know why I introduced it that way. For those of you who don't know what A Song of Ice and Fire is it's a series by George R. R. Martin, and the HBO's TV series A Game of Thrones is based on that. So what we're looking at is a world heavily influenced by our own history, looking at something like War of the Roses, you know, the Civil War in England. And most of the action takes place, or a great deal of the action takes place, on a continent called Westeros, which is like a, I think it's been like compared or described as England, but about the size of South America. Across the ocean would be what, you know, kind of your equivalent of Europe, and beyond that would be the equivalent of Asia. This would be, in contrast to Exalted, which is very much you're playing demigods, this is very much a low magic, low supernatural game. There are undead, there are dragons, there are giants, but a lot of the people don't believe they exist anymore or doubt that they ever existed. This would be a setting like if you had watched, you know, if you're familiar with King Arthur, or if you watched something like Ivanhoe, or if you read Ivanhoe, this would be something that would be very much up your alley. You know, knights.
In football armor? Very painted silver?
What was that? Excalibur? I didn't look like football armor. It's very shiny armor. This, you know, it's got knights, it's got tourneys, it's got a strong emphasis on heraldry.
It's got intrigue.
It does have intrigue. Yeah. So if you watched The Tudors, then again, this would be something that you'd very much be interested in.
So what kind of system does A Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game use?
D6 system. And what it does is it's combined, I think something that distinguishes it from a lot of other games out there, it combines attributes and skills. So you're looking at things like athletics or awareness and cunning, fighting, will. And what your score, much like Exalted, is the number of die that you roll. You can also add specialties, which would give you a bonus die. And what you do is you have difficulty numbers, you roll, you add your dice together, and whether or not they beat that particular difficulty number.
Which is a little bit different than at least most other dice pool systems. Like World of Darkness, you read each die individually, and that tells you the number of successes you get. Whereas in A Song of Ice and Fire, you total all the dice together, and that is your action number, I guess.
Yeah.
So the difficulties can be quite high.
Other special features of the system is they make a lot to do with age. I think one of the more successful ways to differentiate between a young and an old character. And they have a thing called destiny points. Young people who are new to the world and...
can have a big impact on it still?
Yeah, because they got a bright... they have a destiny ahead of them, where an old person maybe doesn't have that anymore. They've either done it or they haven't.
That makes me feel good about the birthday I just had, thanks.
Yeah, all right. Happy birthday, man. So the young person will get a lot of destiny, which they can spend on things called benefits. They can also... which are like special abilities on top of specialties, so...
you can also spend them to keep from dying.
Yep, and then you can also spend it in gameplay to keep from dying and other benefits. But then, to balance it... so, like, yeah, the older you get, the more specialty experience you get. And those are the things you buy, you know, what we said before. You can specialize in different things or add... so that adds to your dice. So, of course, that reflects the fact that you're more experienced.
That's really cool. It's actually very similar to the Fate system. The fewer skills and special abilities that you get, the more Fate points you have.
Yeah, except here it's actually tied to age.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, Fate has that, you know, you lose refresh, but it's just kind of a choice where here you might get like a random age, which you can generate through the book, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really cool.
Should we subtitle this episode, All Games Are Like Fate? Non-D&D fantasy, All Games Like Fate.
So you know, this episode is a lot like Fate.
So we got your catchphrase, Lyle, which is Battletech is better. Yeah. Chris's is now, it's like Fate.
It's like Fate.
Yeah. We'll have to find one for me.
And yours is, hey, Eclipse Phase is awesome.
Yeah, probably. All right, there you go.
Another thing that really distinguishes it, and we said if you like heraldry, they actually give you a lot of decent heraldry rules. And, of course, they have pretty decent rules for intrigue or what we would call like social combat. So, which, of course, Chris is going to say Fate has it as well.
Or Savage World.
I'm chomping at the bit, man.
But for a fantasy game, that is pretty refreshing that you can do that. Because when you watch a movie like, a TV series like The Tudors, there's very little combat going on. Or for example, you watch something like Elizabeth, the movie, and you like that back and forth, and you wonder, well, how do I incorporate that? Is it all just through role-playing? And you're like, well, of course, yes, it could be just that. But sometimes when you build a character, you want to build somebody who's going to be cunning. Those familiar with Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones, will know that there's these characters called maesters, and they are just smart people. And people who have played games where you just have smart people, hello, looking at you, Riffs, when you play like the rogue scholar, the rogue scientist, you might feel like, hey, I don't really have much to do next to this dragon, actually, or the cyber knight. But this actually, with these rules, is somebody smart can do have a great impact on the world. You can play your Tyrion Lannister. And for those who know in the setting, a smart dwarf. Yeah.
I'm picturing a brainy Gimli.
No. A real dwarf. Real dwarf. No, that's actually what attracted me. Or not what attracted me, but that, like, when I read the system, I'm like, wow, all right. Just like in the source material it's from, the intrigue rules allows a clever or an intrigue-based character to be just as effective, if not more dangerous, than the guy with the sword.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the first systems I've seen that handles it in a way that I like, and in a way that makes it look evenly balanced with the combat mechanics.
Yeah, I have to say, I've never found a really good social system in a game that I think is like, oh wow, this does it. But this is probably one of the best ones I've ever seen.
Not even Fate?
This I think is actually a step up from Fate. I'd say it definitely has a potential to.
Yeah. And another thing, does the party get together in the tavern? No. What they do is they encourage you to work as a house. So you have like House Stark, you know, House Lannister, and you can kind of thinking is like, yeah, you can have the noble and his retainers, yeah.
No, I really like that too. Like, there's a whole chapter on house generation, which allows you to find out sort of how big a land holding you have, what's on it, what kind of terrain, how big, you know, the structure is, and then it actually gets down into helping you generate the people of note who will be there, like how many kids the lord has. And I thought that was great because you can then go to the players who are going to be in this game and say, you know, great, here's the house. Here are all the people in it. Do you want to play someone on this list? Do you want to play the firstborn son? Do you want to play the lord? Do you want to play the maester of this house? Or do you want to play like the bastard son of this? And do you want to play a hedge knight? And people could, I think that's a great way to spark character ideas.
Yeah.
Because you just, okay, pick from this list. Who do you want to be? There's no personality. You can make the personality, but this is now your sort of status in the house.
And if you like the more narrative style, then the players can get together and make those roles and do that planning on their own. Mm. And they make the house and then divvy it up. So that's a lot of fun. It's one of those, it's actually one of those games where you can have fun, as lame as it sounds, can have fun without playing it, just rolling up your house going, "Dow!"
Although I have to say, the way to generate your heraldry, I was kind of disappointed. I think we both of us did it, and we ended up with like the same thing. I'm like, yeah, well, like, I got like green and white sinister bend. Yeah, me too. What was your thing on it? Nothing really interesting. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I got a turtle.
No, it wasn't even that. It was like a leaf or something. Like, oh, I really wanted like some kind of like ferocious animal.
Yeah.
Acorn. Oh, crap.
Magic system, not worth speaking of. I mean, it's very, very low magic.
Yeah, I was going to say, not because the system is bad.
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist.
Right. And I'm sure we'll see more in future supplements. Presentation. The first edition had some faults, and I say that knowing that there actually is another edition out now called the Game of Thrones edition, which there happened to be a few more typos than there should have been, including even on the character sheet. So we bought the pocket edition, which cleaned up those mistakes. So slight disadvantage of presentation, although it isn't, yeah, it kind of sold me on the idea of a pocket edition book. It's very convenient.
I don't know what pocket that would fit in, though. It's pretty big still.
Yeah. It's a big pocket. It's like all pocketbooks. Hardly any of them fit in a pocket.
Perhaps we need a new name.
What?
As opposed to pocketbooks.
Oh, I see.
Riveting conversation, guys, really.
All right.
The wheels are turning, trying to think of what the name could be.
Yeah. This is a good example where, like, you don't, even the, like, the pocket edition is black and white, and from what I know, the hardback is full color, but.
Yeah, we
the art is, the art holds up in black and white, and looking through that book, the pocket edition, even though it's black and white, I still think it's very well laid out, and it's a very handsome book.
I saw the new cover. It looks even better. So it looks like the success of a Game of Thrones, the TV series, And the success of this game as well has led Green Ronin to pump a little bit more money, maybe, into the presentation, and it looks really nice. I'm going to order, even though I have this pocket edition, I'm going to order the Game of Thrones edition.
Hardback?
Nice.
It's a hardback, yeah. And when I have a, it's a game I really like, I'll always like spring for the hardback. Gateway or no?
I'm going to say yes, because I think the mechanic is simple enough. You roll these dice, you total them up, tell me what you got. Did you beat the number? Yes. Okay, you succeed.
Okay. Chris?
Actually, I'm going to have to say no. And again, it's kind of a disappointed no. But for the same reason of Exalted, the system is probably pretty easy to buy into, and it's got a lot of nice features that, that could allow a player to really go any direction he wants with a character. And you can also build up a really nice character with the rules in the system. But again, it's pretty heavily tied to the setting. And it's something, if you don't know the setting, it might be hard to buy into the game.
I'm going to disagree there.
Of course.
Because, yeah, of course I am. Because A, I always disagree with you. But unlike Exalted, A Song of Ice and Fire, all you need to know is kind of what was medieval Europe like. You can ignore the metagame. You can ignore sort of the overarching campaign thing. All you have to say, you don't even have to bring any of the houses from the storyline into it. You can just say, great, let's build your house. There it is. And you have, you know, a lord above you, and it's this guy. And they don't need to know who that is from the book to play the game.
And you're absolutely right about that, but we're talking about a fantasy game. Is this a gateway fantasy game? All right, cool, fantasy. I want to play a wizard.
Well, then, so the reason I think this is a gateway, did you like Game of Thrones? Yes, great.
There you go. Do you like anime? Great, Exalted.
Yeah, I'm going to say no as a gateway, even though it is my favorite game of all the ones we're going to talk about in this episode, and one of my favorite games. And yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, we're going to play a fantasy game. Great. Are we going to fight any dragons? No. Can I play a wizard? No. Are we fighting orcs? No. Like, there's so many fantasy tropes that are not here. I mean, yeah, you could say, no, it's like medieval Europe. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of a historical game. And you're like, well, there is some fantasy elements. And then you go back to dragons. Yeah, but they're really tiny right now.
Or they're really, really big, but dead.
Yeah. Dead. 300 years ago. Did we kill them? It doesn't matter. They died inbred. Oh. So, yeah, it's a little bit more sophisticated. I think the system is easy to wrap your head around, but the setting encourages a slightly more sophisticated game than you're the barbarian, you're a knight, you're a wizard, you're a thief, and let's just act out some stereotypes, cliches.
So what you're saying is you got to be sophisticated to play this game, which is why you like it. Ergo, you are sophisticated. So we should all sit around playing this, eating cheese and drinking wine.
I don't think the listeners needed those dots connected.
But, Can I just say, I hope whatever game we look at next gets a thumbs up for a good entry game.
I mean, a gateway, saying something is not a gateway game does not make it a bad game, obviously.
It just makes it a bad game as a gateway.
You say, could you see like somebody new to role-playing? Like, yeah, there's a small group of people that you could make it a gateway game. It's like you sit there and they're like, man, you know, I got to wait another 3 months for the next series or the next season of Game of Thrones. What can I do? Well, why don't we play a role-playing game based off of that? Yeah. Oh, that sounds pretty cool. But most people would be like, they're coming from a more traditional fantasy pathway of Lord of the Rings, or I guess nowadays those computer games and video games, you know, World of Warcraft. And it's like, well, I want to play this. And it's like, oh, they're undead. Yeah, but nobody believes in them. And you got to go way up north. And I'm like, well, I want to play up north.
Exactly. It's nothing against the game. I think it's a fantastic game. It's just it doesn't fit the general conception of fantasy. So
no.
It'd be hard to buy into as a gateway.
But people who like historical games, or people who are like, I want to play Ivanhoe. And you go, do you want to play Ivanhoe? I don't know if anybody would say that these days. Like, who would say that?
They would say, I
want to play a smart dwarf. No, but actually, like you said, Wayne, if you had somebody who was interested in a really social game or something that's a bit more cerebral, then yeah, by all means, this would be a great way to point them.
Yeah. They watch Kingdom of Heaven and they go, I want to play that. You're like, great, got the game for you.
Yeah.
Might be Orlando Bloom? No.
No. What we said before, Orlando Bloom is not the problem with that movie.
No.
Yeah. He wasn't a great movie.
I think the listeners could have connected that dot.
It's not the problem. No. So next up is RuneQuest, and definitely for this game, I have to specify which version we're talking about. We're talking about primarily the 6th edition, but we are going to talk a little bit about some previous editions, because it is such an iconic game.
Yeah.
And you could say that this game, when it came out, it was one of the big three. It was the second fantasy game, and it was up there with Traveller and D&D as one of the
big three.
big three. No, you could say that. In fact, I did say that.
Well said, Lyle, twice.
A little assist from Wayne. Gosh. All right. So, Chris, take it away, please.
Yeah, I guess to start off, like, actually, you said focusing on the 6th edition, but we have to go back a little bit for setting, because the 6th edition didn't have that. But, man, this is actually pretty tough, because the setting for RuneQuest is just enormous. It's called Glorantia, and the setting is almost 60 years old, and it's been kind of out in the world, in the internet, and there's lots of player contributions, and it's simply enormous. Yeah, basically, it's a fantasy world, and pretty much by definition, though, it's a little bit more fantastic than your basic D&D or Lord of the Rings kind of thing. Like, dwarves are actually made of stone, and elves are intelligent plant creatures. The gods and pantheon is a lot more involved in the game. Like, the barbarians are direct descendants of the storm god, and it's kind of the lunar empire, and the solar empire, which are direct descendants of those gods. So yeah, it's huge.
So it's traditional fantasy on steroids.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good way of putting it, yeah.
One thing I found interesting about the original setting was everybody's part of a cult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you kind of go through that.
Yeah, it's true. One of the interesting parts, and I guess this kind of goes into the magic of the system, is that there aren't wizards or clerics or anything per se. Everyone has access to magic. If you pray to the gods, you can receive spells. If you study magic scriptures, then you can also cast the spells. Not everyone is of equal ability in doing so, but it is open.
Hmm. Yeah. I remember I didn't have the role-playing game as a kid. You know, I had D&D, and my parents bought me a Dragon Pass, which was it predates RuneQuest, the role-playing game. Mm-hmm. And I guess the guy, Greg Stafford, and he developed this board game, and wow, I just drew a blank, because I didn't have the previous title. I had Dragon Pass. And he was trying to get a publisher, and he couldn't find anybody to publish his board game, so that's how Chaosium started.
Huh. Chaosium, not Chaosium?
Or Chaosium. Mm. Which came out of Chaosium.
Or fell into it.
Chaosium! Now I'm crawling out of that Chaosium right now.
Yeah, as it says, the original RuneQuest, not the one that I had, came with the Dragon Pass as its area. There's a map and kind of sample adventure hooks along with it too. So
yeah. It was a really cool board game.
Yeah, it sounds interesting.
And I guess they had like a little army of like ducks.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, anthropomorphic ducks.
That would actually kind of turn me off a little bit.
But it's not like they were the only army, but right. Then you would get like. At this guy, one of the heroes, and he was kind of looked like it. You ever watch Fire and Ice?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was like the guy with the axe.
Yeah.
What's his name? Dark Wolf?
Right.
Yeah. It was like him, except with like claws and that. Yeah, badass.
I don't know, like that was actually, back when I played back in the day, we kind of actually just ignored the half-men, half-duck creature, because they're pretty much dumb.
Oh, I didn't say that was a great part of it, but I was like, that was something that stood out in my mind.
Yeah. Mm. Well, again, the stuff is pretty out there. Like, a lot of the monster races were really strange stuff. Like, the trolls in this one, they were like bats. They had a sonar sense to it, and they could eat rocks and all kinds of stuff. It was cool.
So what kind of system is attached to it? Hey, isn't that yours one?
Hey, nice. What a segue. It's set up off of the basic role-playing system by Steve Perrin. Yeah, it's entirely skill-based. It's on percentile systems. There's no levels or anything like in D&D. It's so the combat in it is a bit slower, but it's a lot more realistic. I guess it's based off of Steve Perrin's experience reenacting medieval combats. And yeah.
Okay, so when you say it's entirely skill based, like skill based as in A Song of Fire and Ice role playing game, where you don't really have any attributes or stats.
You do have stats.
It just introduced skills, not the first game to do so, but it was one of the first games to really emphasize the usage of skills in the game. So they did have, like, you know, attributes like that were very comparable to Dungeons and Dragons. Mm. But if you remember, like, old first edition D&D, you compare that to any game with skills.
You're like, whoa, what are these?
Yeah.
Hey, all these things I use in everyday life, yeah.
Well, I mean, you were talking about Call of Cthulhu earlier, Wayne. It was the same kind of thing. You had size, strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, power, and appearance. And those stats came together to so you could derive your base skills. Then you could improve the skills later on. Yeah, this is pretty cool. I didn't like the advancement system all that much with it, because you had to roll over your skill on a percentile dice. So if you were really unlucky, you could go for a really long time without any improvement. But it is a nice balanced way. You know, your skills improve a lot more naturally than with D&D, rather than leaps and bounds. It is harder to improve a higher skill. So it is quite realistic.
We talked before about, you know, the level system is fun. It's not realistic. You know, you get all this mm-hmm. cool stuff at one time, and you're like, oh, you can plan out what, you know, you're going to get at certain levels. So, I don't know, I think games have to strike a balance between, or they at least have to decide, are they going to be realistic, or are they going to be abstract, but maybe potentially more fun? And, as you said, like, mm-hmm. RuneQuest or having to roll over your skill, yeah, it makes sense, you know, and I'm sure there's some kind of mechanic where maybe you get a better chance if you actually fail, or, you know, you actually have to use the skill if you want to improve it, but that mm-hmm. might not necessarily be fun.
Yeah.
But you said that everyone in the world actually gets to use magic?
Yeah, depending on what edition and what supplements you have, there's basically divine, sorcery, and battle magic. And those kind of the three different classes, there's not that much difference between them, but the way you do it is not advancing at all. It's where you have your entire spell list available to you, and you roll once to see if you're able to recall the spell, and then once to attempt to cast it. So it's kind of nice that you have a full repertoire available to you, and it's based on your skills. It's not a mana power system either. I guess some other cool bits about it were it had these really awesome critical hit charts, you know, where you would roll on a D100 and it'd have all these different spaces where you could lop somebody's head straight off, or with the magic ones, like, they explode in this huge burst of flame. Stuff that was always a lot of fun. And the monsters in it that were all built with the exact same rule system as the players were. So the game openly encouraged players to play any kind of race that they wanted to. And so was, the setting was a very pluralist kind of thing. Really anything was okay to be anywhere.
No.
So it's cool.
What do you think? Gateway? No Gateway? Or if you like... You would like RuneQuest?
Yes, I think it could be a gateway, because the setting is so large and open that you can go into it without any knowledge of it, what you could easily find anything online about it. But that said, I think there are other games that would be better gateways,
yeah.
Like D&D, for example.
Like, I do agree, like, the setting is kind of that open fantasy setting. You can play anything you want. Can I play a dwarf? Yeah, sure. Can I play, you know, dark elf? Yeah, sure. I'm sure it's in there. But the system looked fairly complicated from what I read.
Yeah, Lyle said it. It's an old school system. There's the book is full of charts.
It has percentile, which people get. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very easy to say it's a percentile system, and they're like, I get you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I'm like, 70% is all right, 30% is not okay. You know, it's. I mean, if you say, like, even like something like Song of Ice and Fire, you're like, I'm a 3. Okay, is that good? Out of what?
Yeah, it says I hear I've got melee combat of 3D.
Yeah, what 16 out of 100.
I've only got 5 dots. That sucks.
Yeah.
I think it may have a bit of an opposite problem of the systems we were saying earlier, in that the setting is not inaccessible or dense, but the system is.
Yeah. I think you also kind of get into a little bit of the blank canvas problem, or at least from my perspective, you know.
Yeah, good point.
There is no kind of defined setting, so everybody could probably come at it from different angles, where part of the reason why I like at least the idea behind Exalted and the Song of Ice and Fire is the party knows what it is.
Yeah.
Where yeah. RuneQuest, hey, you can play anything you want. Great. Why are we together? Let's find out, you know?
Tavern!
Yeah. Go to the tavern. So, and maybe not an entry game. But again, if someone knew how to play it, or if the DM knew how to play it well, I think any game kind of works as an entry game.
Yeah, I'm going to say no, but not a clear no like the other ones.
Mm.
But I do think the fact that some of the earlier editions kind of damaged the IP, the intellectual property,
mm-hmm.
is that people don't know what RuneQuest is anymore and what that means. And really, you're buying this, you're not getting a RuneQuest setting. You're getting
right. The
RuneQuest system.
Yeah.
And I think that stuff can really hurt the game. And it's like, okay, it's a generic setting. Okay, I get that. But is there anything about Dragon Pass? Probably people never heard of that, but...
Right.
For example, and it's like, nah, nothing about that. All right.
So we've said no to everything so far.
Yeah.
D&D it is.
So for the last of our regular game, we've got Dragon Age. And we should probably say it is the role-playing game based on the computer game.
Hmm.
Or the pen and paper role. You know, I hate saying that, pen and paper role-playing.
Yeah.
Because, damn you, no, that's a computer RPG.
Yeah. No, that's not an RPG.
This is the RPG based off the computer RPG. I never even played the computer game.
Yeah, neither have I. But yeah. I think you could call a computer RPG is a railroad playing game.
Yeah.
Because you can't really do anything. But
anyway. We digress.
So I'll be right up front. The Dragon Age setting, kind of boring. it seems like very traditional Tolkien-esque fantasy. There are mainly humans. There are a small number of dwarves who live underground and... kind of mysterious.
There's a small number of dwarves who don't.
Yeah. And there's,
not so mysterious.
There's elves who are not mobile plant people, you know? So, humans, elves, dwarves. That's essentially it.
I really don't like what they did with the elves. They kind of just seem, it's like they're a slave race.
Mm-hmm.
Or were. And then they've been liberated. Now they just kind of like, some of them went to the woods. Some of them stayed in the cities. And they found out if they're in close proximity to humans, that they kind of lose their immortality. Or so you're like, oh, so you, now there's nothing to distinguish you from humans.
Yeah.
It's like, they're just like humans with pointy ears, except with a bit of a victim complex.
Hmm. Well, I think they do live longer than average human.
But with those lives, would you want to?
Probably not.
Yeah, and they're all, yeah, the ones that live in the city, they're all like, oh, and they're like the domestic servants. And like,
they're essentially the Uncle Tom elves, let's be honest.
So the plus side is you're going to live forever. The downside is it's as a slave.
No, you're not even going to live forever. You're just going to live longer.
Do you really want to live forever? No, the answer is no.
But
forever made, I want to be
forever. All right. But the thing I do like about Dragon Age is the mechanics behind it.
Sorry, rush to the setting.
Right.
It is based on a computer RPG, and those people who are familiar with computer RPGs, generally the settings just don't have the depth, the complexity, the richness that something like Lord of the Rings or Song of Ice and Fire is going to have, or even your bog standard regular role-playing game.
The thing that interested me about Dragon Age was sort of the mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, my problem with sort of the D20 system is there's no bell curve, right? You have a 5% chance of rolling everything, where Dragon Age sort of uses a 3d6 mechanic, which, in my opinion, gives you a nice variation. Basically, it strips down your stats to a range between -2 and 4. And the basic mechanic is you roll 3d6, you add the number to your stat, maybe you add 1 or 2 extra points for having a bonus focus, and you compare it to a target number. So, sort of similar to a Song of Ice and Fire, or Fate, Chris, there you go. But
why are you giving me attitude for not even saying it?
I'm cutting you off early. But that was my problem with D&D. I felt like, you know, there was no real control over what you had with that D20 roll, where a 3d6 will give you an average.
That's really cool. I've actually seen homebrews for using D&D as a 3d6 system because of the bell curve.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things about Dragon Age is one of the die you're supposed to roll is supposed to be a different color, and that's called the dragon die. And that does extra things at certain times. Like, if you do really well on like a combat check, the dragon die allows you to spend those points to do stunts. You know, like you roll 5 on the dragon die, you get 5 stunt points to use then and there for some kind of stunt during combat.
That's cool.
At first I was kind of, didn't really like it because you couldn't plan around the stunts, but now looking at it, it's like, I kind of think that's a good thing. It adds that little spice to combat where you don't really know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The character creation system's pretty easy to get your head around.
Mm.
And kind of had some elements that you're kind of seeing popping up in D&D next. You choose a background, and that could be like the oh-so-exciting city elf that we've complained about. And then you add onto that a class, and something that we didn't mention is that the way they're rolling out Dragon Age, they're rolling it out in box sets. The plan is 3, so they've only have the first 2 box sets out. So in the first box set, which is what we have, is just warrior, rogue, and mage. Are your 3 classes, and the other ones are going to be adding more as it goes on. Mm. But yeah, it's pretty easy. You pick your background, you pick your class. I think it's very easy to build a character.
And just kind of similar to D&D Next, by picking those backgrounds or classes, they actually give bonuses to stats or give you things. They're not just flavor things. It's like, okay, you picked, the Circle Mage background. Oh, that means you get bonuses to these, attributes and these skills and these sort of feats, which it kind of makes character creation really easy. Great, what do you want to be? Oh, okay, now tack on this little thing and tack on this extra thing, and there you go. You're done.
Yeah,
and it's worth mentioning, too, that doing that also gives you background flavor-wise, too.
Hmm.
What about the magic system?
You get a certain number, if you're a magic user, you get a certain number of spells, at the beginning of the game that you choose from a list, and those are cast by spending magic points, essentially. Kind of similar to Savage World, certain spells, you can spend more than the required amount to have extra effects, like a bigger fireball or more magic missiles or more dice when you attempt to heal someone. Mm-hmm. So you tend to regain power points fairly rapidly. For every hour you spend, you get back a certain number. So I like it better than the Vancian magic system of D&D because it puts a limit on spell casting. You can only cast so many spells during the course of a battle. But if you're sort of careful, you don't have to then take an 8-hour rest to get all your spells back. You know, they just kind of slowly come back over a short period of time.
You've always been a big fan of like the resource management aspect of mages, so yeah, I can see where you're going.
So what about the presentation?
I think it looks gorgeous.
Do you think it's a good idea? Yeah, it does look good. The art's good. What you get in the box set's pretty cool.
The layout's very nice and clear, which I like.
It's easy to follow. Is the box set the right approach to roll out 3 separate box sets?
Sounds like a profitable one.
I'm going to say yes, because like in addition to only probably having certain classes in the box, I think the first box only goes up to level 5.
Yeah.
So, well, people like us, right, who are kind of established role players might complain about that and say, oh, just give me all the way up to level 20 or however high you're going to go. I think it allows Green Ronin to sort of target newer role players a lot easier, because instead of having all the rules all the way up to level 20 or 30, it can focus much more on, hey, here's what you do when you gain a level. You do X, Y, and Z. And I think it just makes it a lot easier for new people to get into it.
Hmm. Oh, I agree. I think it's different. Or actually, it's in a sense very old school, but it is new school in the sense that I think people who are used to computer games, they'd be used to that. You buy something and then you buy the next edition. I think they're very familiar with that, or add-ons and, you know, downloading other things to expand it.
That's essentially what it is. It's an add-on. The next box will be levels 6 through 10 and new classes. Maybe even like new prestige classes where you wouldn't have to make a new character. Yeah. You say, oh, great, and now I'm 6th level. I get to take this extra, for lack of a better term, prestige class to make my guy different, but he's still the same.
Yeah,
but I think the biggest advantage is exactly what you said. It's allowed them to deliver the game in nice bite-sized pieces. And I would certainly, I would feel pretty excited if I got into the game. I mean, I'd be like, you'd be somewhat disappointed it capped at 5th level. Hmm. But then you're excited about the next thing rolling out. And the only challenge then is for Green Ronin is to make sure that they're rolling out the box sets at a sufficient pace.
Hmm. Yeah, you risk losing a lot of players if you just don't roll it out when everybody reaches level 5.
Yep.
Yeah, it's true. But it also gives them time to make sure that things aren't broken as well.
Yeah.
Like they can really play test the higher levels and make sure that, hey, they don't kind of break the game or these do all work together.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd hope that they'd do that kind of playtesting before they release the system.
And then they can always release the box or the box set or the book that will combine everything.
Yeah.
After they have the 3 box sets.
Yeah. I guess adding to the ease, and I guess I should have mentioned this before, there are only, as you probably said, 3 classes in the book. Warrior, Rogue, and Magic User.
Yes.
And again, that's kind of all you need. You know, you can sort of fit any archetype in there and it's just easy. Magic.
Yep.
I want to be a wizard. Okay, great. Magic User. I know you fight a guy. Oh, fighter. Duh.
Yeah. And for that matter, even the rogue isn't even like a skill specialist. He's more of a dexterity fighter.
Right.
So gateway or not?
You know, of all the ones we reviewed today, this one is actually the most gateway. It's the one that I'm least interested in actually trying out, but it's easy. The world is pretty flat, so it's not too hard to jump into. The simple classes with a template system, you choose your background, choose your character style, and you're done. The magic points for the magic system is pretty intuitive. Yeah, I think it would be really easy for new players to jump into.
Definitely thumbs up for a gateway game. I'm more excited to play it than Chris is because the stunt die mechanic looks pretty cool.
Definitely a gateway because they have delivered the rules in a really easy way. It's laid out really well. The setting I'm very unexcited about, but honestly, I've never been excited about any of these computer role-playing game backgrounds. So certainly if we're talking about as a gateway, then people are going to find it as interesting as those computer games. But also, it's generic enough that you could really just do whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you're not so tied to this world that it has a history, but it doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's not like Exalted where you need to explain where all the solar came from.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's just like, well, it's kind of your standard thing. Do you have elves? Yeah.
But you don't want to play them.
Yeah. I can live forever. Yeah, kind of.
No, I think that's a good point, because it's kind of like...
If you call that living.
You know, as you said, it bite size is the buzzword here, right? It doesn't suffer from the blank canvas problem, right? It's generic enough, but it's also very narrow.
Yeah. It's also, even though we've just complained about the domestic elf, and they do have the city dwarves, which kind of like merchants, it does help you get those people together. It's not like, well, why are the elves hanging out with the humans? And you're just like...
Because you're my slave.
Because I pay you. Or just like, well, you're a merchant, you know.
Great, why am I adventuring? I should be buying and selling things.
All right, thanks for working with me, Thor. So it does make it a little bit easier to get people together.
Hmm. Yeah.
And even though we kind of raved about A Song of Ice and Fire saying, well, you're all in the same house, or Exalted is like, you're all solars, you know, you're all like touched at that same essence there. Some people might find that a bit constricting, and, you know, they might chafe at that, those. But here is like, you're in the same city, okay? Yeah, I guess. All right, same city.
Frequent the same tavern every day? Yeah, okay.
But hey, if they're Gateway, maybe they're not familiar with the whole you start in a tavern setting, so it's okay.
Yeah, they'd be like, wow, that was amazing. And then we met in a tavern, like, who was in a tavern?
Wow! You're a genius.
Yeah, what's that phrase? Yeah, if you have an experience that's new to you.
Yeah. So definitely, yeah, thumbs up. And finally, this is not a game that you can actually buy, so that's why we didn't want to present it in the same way, but it was a game that we're really excited about. It was amazing, but our experience with this game is a miniatures game, and it's called Chronopia. People who are familiar with the Mutant Chronicles, made by the same people.
Yeah.
The Mutant Chronicles, they also made, or became like Warzone.
I know Mutant Chronicles as Warzone, miniatures game, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we actually originally were like, well, Chronopia, make that a role-playing game. And then we did a little research and like, oh, it was.
Yeah.
But it was in Swedish, so.
Yeah.
So we can be forgiven for not knowing that. So we knew that the miniatures game was from Sweden, which explains some of the shaky English.
Yeah.
But we didn't know that they actually, it has an interesting background is where they kind of make like kind of a D&D style game, and it was using basic role-playing rules. And by basic role-playing, we mean the basic role-playing system. And using Elric cover art, like a real mishmash of fantasy thing. Yeah, so they did that. But some of the things that they've done, and you know, the reason why it came up is because we were complaining about the Dragon Age elves.
Oh, yeah.
And saying, it's like, well, you know, people really have trouble, like, making really different but cool elves. But
and then Chronopia, it came up, it's like, hey, we got those wussy city elves. And you know who would kick their butts? Yeah, those Chronopia elves. And we were like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Those guys were awesome.
Yeah, so like one of the unit types you could play is these guys in plate armor and axes, and you're like, well, they're the elves.
Whoa, wait. Since when do elves use axes? Well, in Chronopia they do.
Yeah. They're also into drugs. Yeah. You know, a lot of lotus eaters. And then we look at what they've done with all the other races. The dwarves are like beast clans.
Yeah.
And they kind of look like their totems. They all have these animal totems, and they have these characteristics that are similar to the actual atoms.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Kind of turning stuff on its head, like the Black Blood Empire, which are your goblins, orcs, trolls, and ogres, have this sort of Middle Eastern or Arabian sort of flavor to them, where they're actually really intelligent. They're the sort of alchemists or the astrologers of the world. And you're like, wow, that's different from your kind of classic. I mean, they still loot and pillage and murder, but they're smart about it.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, they have a civilization.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty interesting one, too.
Then you have the Firstborn, and they kind of look like if you combined like the guys from Mad Max, you know, Humongous from Mad Max with like a knight or something like that. They look pretty cool, and they're kind of they have an interesting story where they're like what, freed slaves?
Yeah, like they were like they're called Firstborn because you know they were originally on the world, and then they kind of subjugated the other races, and the other races said nope, you know, sort of broke their empire and enslaved them, and where the story is now. They've sort of broken off these shackles due to a profit and kind of reestablished their empire. And it's a miniatures game, as we said, which means you sort of need to give a reason for all the factions to fight each other. No one can really be friends. And sort of that's the reason, you know, like, hey, not only elves and dwarves or, you know, dwarves and goblins hate each other in this setting. Everybody hates everybody else. Now, that being said, you could not really play. I don't really think you could play a mixed race party. You'd probably have to pick one race. And stick to it. You know, everybody in the group would have to be either Firstborn or from one of the Elven houses or the Black Blood Empire.
It's also the Devout.
Which is a kind of an interesting take on the undead because, again, they were at one time part of the sort of the Firstborn nation and the rulers of the undead legions now used to be the sort of the king's advisors and they figured he was going a way that he shouldn't and then they sort of defected and started working other kinds of magic. So, again, it's I like it because it's a setting where no one is definitely good, which I tend to think is kind of boring, you know? When you can say, oh, this is the good race or this is the good faction, it's kind of not that interesting.
Sounds pretty cool.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, to kind of make this your own system, I mean, you could go back to their source and build it on BRP, which would basic role-playing, which would be pretty easy to do. I mean, it's designed to handle a lot of different things. Or even if you were like to take and transport certain races and put them into your own world, imagine taking one of these races and putting it into a Dragon Age.
I was actually thinking just do the whole world in the Dragon Age rules.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That sounds pretty sweet, actually.
Yeah, what do you want to be? I want to be an elf. Oh, all right.
You just got cool.
Yeah.
Actually, the Dragon Age rules with the background class combination could help, because it is a miniatures game. So what does a miniature game do? It often differentiates or has many different warrior types. Because, I mean, you're just fighting a battle. So the backgrounds can be what you would put onto the warrior class.
Hmm.
You know, it helps.
Oh, nice. Yeah, just like what we talked about with the Stormtroopers episode. Hey, for example, you could have a background of this character fought in this certain battle, and therefore he's really good, maybe, setting spears against charging knights or something, because the enemy used charge down the forces with heavy cavalry.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with the flavor-wise, but I was also just thinking, almost like the unit type, like an Elvish War Killer and stuff like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, I could see those easily being kind of translated into background.
Yeah.
You know, great. Pick the warrior class, and then you have all these backgrounds from the faction, you know, you kind of built your character from.
So kind of like the themes then in D&D Next.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that'd be pretty cool.
Definitely.
Sounds it.
Yeah, so Chronopia is out of print. So it might actually be difficult to get your hands on Chronopia.
I've got all the books back in the States.
Yeah. But if you do manage to get your hands on those, even though it's a miniatures game, I think you'd be pretty pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay, well, that was a kind of a counterbalance to our uber fluffy scientific romance.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is we kind of postponed our episodes on Oscar Wilde and
the Transcendentalist movement. That's next week.
And we thought we'd do something that is very much gamey and recommending some games. So sometimes we can
wax poetic.
Yeah, we can get a little lost in fluffy. The history of the world.
Fluffy.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, I want to give a shout-out as well to GURPS as well. It is also a very good fantasy system that we unfortunately didn't have time to get through today, but is also a great one to look into.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. I mean, we're not saying that these are the only non-D&D fantasy games that you should consider, but these are certain ones that stood out, and unfortunately we didn't have time to do GURPS, because we do talk about GURPS a lot when we talk about other genres.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd shine a spotlight on the ones that are more exclusively fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the website, or download it through DriveThruRPG, or on Stitcher, or stream it through iTunes. You can also post in our forums, look us up on Facebook, through Twitter, or even just send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you. So thanks, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.